Just to let you know that the homework, the actual homework, will be in the wiki in 1 or 2 hours, okay? At, before noon today, the homework will be in the wiki. And I want to encourage you. So I believe the homework, I hope the homework will not take you too much time. And one of the reasons is that that it was designed in that way is so that you can review what we have done during this week too, okay? Especially during the tutorials. So at the moment, it might sound as if what you have done during the tutorials didn't have much relation to what we did during the lectures, but every single bit that you have done during the tutorials will come back during the lectures next week. So it will be very important for you guys to review everything that you have done, and then, especially because it's a long weekend, so when we come back on Monday, Tuesday, we all know what we're talking about. Okay. So that was only to remind me to say that. Okay, so let's review a little bit of what we did yesterday. So we were discussing the closed stream. And yesterday what we did was to find the most general solution that is compatible with the closed stream boundary conditions, which Trevor discovered, which were the boundary conditions that allow us to get rid of the boundary terms in the variation of the action by simply postulating or simply imposing that the string or the field configuration is periodic in the sigma direction with period pi. Okay? Very good. And we found the solution. If we add up the two pieces, we find something that looks like this, I believe. Okay. Now, the first thing we want to do today is to give an interpretation. Well, here I'm missing something. An interpretation to this guy. Remember, we found that for the solution to be periodic, we had to impose that alpha 0 and alpha 0 tilde were the same. Remember, that was one condition that we had to impose in order to get something that was periodic in sigma. Okay? Very good. In order to give an interpretation to this thing, we have to review a little bit Neffer's theorem. Okay? So, this is one of the great things about dealing with actions and Lagrangians, which is that there is a precise connection between global symmetries and conserved charges. Okay? Very roughly, or just schematically, the idea is that if we have an action that depends on some field phi, asymmetry means that we find some transformation of our field, okay? Such that it leaves the action invariant, okay? Now, know that here I haven't said that this field satisfies the field equations, okay? So this is something that is supposed to leave the action invariant for any field configuration. Okay? This is very important, any field configuration. So what do we get? Very good. So we get that if we perform the variation of the action, we get zero. And we get something that looks, this is by assumption. We're assuming that under this transformation, we get that the action is invariant. Now here, we're also assuming that these parameters are constants, okay? So the trick in order to get a conserved charge or to relate symmetries to conserved charge is to allow epsilon to be a function of the coordinates. Okay, so if you feel phi depends on x, on coordinates x, you promote epsilon to be a function of x2. Okay? Now, we said that this was a symmetry, or this was a global symmetry of your action. Nobody said anything about parameters that depend on the space-time location. Okay? That means that when we perform the variation with this new epsilon that depends on x, we don't expect to get zero. Okay? There is no reason to expect to get zero because this was only a global symmetry, meaning that the transformation didn't depend on the space-time point. And therefore, we would expect this thing to be something of the form, well, depending on the number of dimensions, let's put it m. Okay? We expect this thing to be something that depends on the derivative of this parameter. It's actually, we're doing it in any dimensions, so let's put an m here, times some object that can contract with this to produce a scalar. Okay? And the reason we expect this is that we know that if epsilon happens to be something that does not depend on x, we're supposed to get zero. Okay? So this is for an epsilon that is constant. For an epsilon that depends on x, we're supposed to get something like this, so that we get back this result. Okay? Now, the deep inside is the following. If you now take fields phi that satisfy the equations of motion, well, what does it mean that you satisfy the equations of motion? It means that any variation of the action, if you plug in the field equations, if you plug in something that satisfies this equation of motions, you're supposed to get zero, no matter which variation it was, right? So in particular, even this guy, even this variation where epsilon depends on x, is just one more variation. There is really no difference. It's just one particular variation of the action. And that means that if we plug in this formula, something that satisfies the equations of motion, we are supposed to get zero. Okay? But then we conclude that whatever object we found here must satisfy this property when evaluated on field configurations that satisfy the equations of motion. Now, if we integrate by parts, we get minus d4x del m jm epsilon of x. And this must be true for any epsilon-dependent object. Yes? Oh, it's difficult to see that here. OK. Well, the conclusion we find is that by integrating by parts, we find that the divergence of this vector must integrate to zero for any function epsilon of x. And the only way this can happen is if this object by itself is zero. Okay? And this is the statement that this current, we call this a current, and this is the statement that this current is conserved. Okay? Now, what do we do with this? Well, we very simply integrate over the space components, okay, m minus 1. I'm not including time here. The zero component of this current, and this gave us a conserved charge. Does everybody know why this is conserved? Conserved means that if we take the derivative with respect to time, we get zero. So it means that it's conserved along the evolution of the system. Does anybody know why? Very quickly. If I build this object from this current, I guarantee that this object is conserved in time. Does anybody know why? Or is it too trivial that... Yeah. So how do we see it? Well, we want to show that the derivative with respect to time is zero. So we apply derivative with respect to time to check what it is. We pass it through. Now we get derivative with respect to time here, right? But we said that this was zero, okay? But this is the full n-dimensional divergence, right? So the derivative with respect to time happens to be equal to the divergence only in the spatial directions, right? So we can replace that here, and by Gauss's theorem, we get zero, right? Is that clear? Well, you don't seem very. Yeah, maybe this is too trivial. I mean, you have seen this many times, I presume. But let's just do it. So if we want to compute Q dot, we get this minus one derivative with respect to time. Okay. Now we can replace this by this because this is zero, and this is zero because now we are integrating J over the surface element at infinity of the current. And if the current vanishes nicely at infinity, we get that Q dot is also zero. Now, there are weird situations when the current doesn't quite do something very nice at infinity, and the charge doesn't exist. That might happen, okay? But the current always exists. Of course, we're not going to be dealing with cases where the charge doesn't exist, but just keep that in mind. It's not always true that the charge exists because this integral might not converge, okay? In any case, what are the global symmetries of our action? Do you remember? We did that many times. We talk about the global symmetries of this guy. Remember these contractions here, these squares, say this means x mu, eta, mu, nu. Okay? So all the contractions of the x fields, of the scalar fields, from the world sheet point of view, are contractions using the Minkowski metric in the target space. So that means that if we perform a Lorentz transformation, we get back the same action, right? Now, it's important that these matrices do not depend on sigma and tau. So this is a global symmetry, okay? Now, from this global symmetry, according to the theorem, we should have a conserved charges. Now, what are the conserved charges associated to this? This is something you will need in your homework. So the conserved charges associated to that are precisely the components of the angular momentum. So J here is not a... Yeah. So we get okay. Let's just say that this is the right. So these are the conserved charges we will get for these guys. Okay. Remember, we need a current. The current has an index. Yeah, let's not get into that. Let's simply say that this is an exercise for you from the homework to show that associated to that global symmetry, you will get something like this. Remember, here we're only supposed to integrate over the space part, okay? So in the world sheet, we only have one dimension, which is sigma, and that dimension happens to be compact. And what is this going to be? This is going to be x mu, x nu. This dot means a contraction. Sorry, there is no contraction here. There is x nu, x mu, okay? So you will have to use, or you will have to show that this is true. But there is another global symmetry. Do you remember what was the other global symmetry? What else can we do to this field X? This was one of the very first things we discussed. Actually, it was the first global symmetry we discussed for any action that had GR plus scalar fields plus the cosmological constant. Very good translation, because only derivatives appear here. So the next global symmetry would be a translation, again, by something that doesn't depend on sigma or tau. Okay, no dependence on sigma and tau. This is, again, a global symmetry. And there should be some conserved charge associated to it. And that conserved charge is, of course, the momentum. And you are supposed to show, you will show that this is equal to this quantity. Okay? And that's what we're going to use right now. In fact, there is no factor of 2 here, because you will have to take a derivative in the Lagrangian, and this factor of 2 will kill the half that we have here. And the same thing will happen here. Sorry about that. But that factor of 2 is going to be important. OK, so let's use this. Let's plug this object into that equation. Okay? So we want to compute this conserved charge for this field configuration. So what do we get? Anyone? I don't want to do the computation. You can tell me what it is. We want to take the time derivative of this guy, of this object here, and integrate from 0 to pi. What's the answer? So let's use this here. What did you say it was, Jens? You said it was 2 pi ls. Did everybody get this? Well, very quickly, how does it happen? Well, when we take the derivative with respect to tau, this doesn't contribute. We get a contribution from here without the tau, of course. So we get a 2 ls alpha 0 mu plus contributions from the oscillators. But we are integrating from 0 to pi, so all the oscillators drop out, right? So there is no contribution from any of these terms due to the integral over sigma. So this is the only contribution, which is a pi because it doesn't depend on sigma, and this is what we get. So we find something very interesting. We find that alpha naught has a nice physical meaning. It's actually the momentum, the space-time momentum of the particle, of the string, divided by 2 pi alpha string. And I forgot the t here, right? So there is a t divided by t. OK, very good. So if we plug that back here, now remember, there is only one dimension-full parameter in the whole story. What is the only dimension-full parameter that we have? L, or alpha prime. Remember, our goal is to reproduce this alpha prime. So in fact, this is true in general. In string theory, there is only one parameter, which is alpha prime. Okay? So this is a very constrained theory. I mean, it's not like you have many tunable parameters and you can do whatever you want. You have a single parameter, alpha prime. Once you fix it, then the whole theory is supposed to tell you what's going to happen next. So this alpha string, this string length, has no choice but to be proportional to alpha prime, right? This is the only dimension-full parameter, and it has dimensions of length squared. So we can choose the proportionality constant to be 2, say. This is convenient. So when we plug that in there, what we find is that this object turns out to be, let's see, want to get it right. So it turns out to be, yeah, we can just leave it in terms, remember the tension was 1 over 2 pi alpha prime, okay? So we can express the tension in terms of the string length using this relation and plug it in there and get something that looks like this. Okay? For this quantity. Yes?
Where did the T come from?
Which T? The tension.
Yeah, it appears only in the conserved charges for the first time. So I don't know. Did you just put it in there by hand?
No, very good, very good. Remember, we started with this action. Does anybody know how the T came to life? How did the T appear?
The action has to be dimensionless.
Yes, and we want to give an interpretation to this axis as well.
Coordinates.
As coordinates in space-time. So these guys carry dimension in space-time, carry dimensions of length, and we decided that this action didn't make sense like that. So yesterday we said that we had to put a dimension-full parameter with dimensions of 1 over length squared, 1 over length of space-time squared. And we also said that we will find that tension is related to alpha prime. Actually, that's one of the purposes of the homework, is to actually show that if you make this choice, you will precisely reproduce a Rayleigh behavior that we discussed relating the mass of the strings and the angular momentum. Okay, is that clear? Very good. Okay, so this is what we get here. So let me remove this and put times. Okay. Very good. But now we are done with the classical solution. Sorry? Yes, thank you. I forgot the square. But we know that just finding solutions to the classical equations of motion is not enough. What do we have to do now? Yeah, that would be great, yeah. But before we quantize it, remember, there is something else. Is any solution of this form is an allowed solution to our original problem? Remember, the original problem was the Nambu-Goto action, which was too complicated. Then we showed that it was equivalent to this Polyakov action with a metric with H alpha beta. But we got rid of that guy by using a gauge fixing condition. But when we do that, what do we have to do? We have to remember to impose the constraints. And yesterday, we left us an exercise to show that the constraints, i.e. the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor, in the new coordinates, in the Lycon coordinates, meant that we had to require that this vanishes, as well as the corresponding statement with x minus. Okay? So that's what we want to see today. We want to see how these constraints look like, or how these are constraints on the oscillators. Okay, very good. So, yesterday, remember, when we tried to find our solution here, the first statement we made was that the derivative with respect to sigma minus or sigma plus of x happens to be a function that is periodic in sigma, right? So let's also use that fact here. Let's use that the solutions here, or that our functions are periodic. and give an expansion to these guys. A Fourier expansion, okay? So we are going to give a Fourier expansion of this, and we're going to say, just like we did yesterday, and we're going to call the Fourier modes Lm. Okay? Now remember, the reason we introduced the string length here, what was the reason? Do you remember? We said that we wanted the Fourier modes to be dimensionless, so we had to pull out the dimensions here. So likewise, we want these guys to be dimensionless, so we want to pull out the dimension explicitly. This has dimensions of length square, so we make this definition to pull out the dimensions so that these guys are dimensionless. Now we want to compute them in terms of the oscillators. How can we do that? Well, it turns out that people like to call these ones L tilde, right? Because we're taking derivatives with respect to sigma plus. So the only oscillators that will contribute will be these guys. And that's why we should keep the convention that the tilde goes with the tilde. Okay? Well, let's try to compute it. Let's plug in the solution. Okay? So one way would be to expand this like crazy and try to combine one with the other. But another way would be to integrate the whole thing from 0 to pi d sigma with, say, if we do this, what are we going to get? If you plug this formula in here, what do you get? Yes, so this would be precisely 2LS squared LN. Okay? Very good. Let's even take this whole thing at tau equals to 0. So we don't think too much about the plus here. Let's just think that we have at tau equals to 0. And let's carry out this computation. So what do we get? We have to plug in this formula. Okay? From 0 to pi, now we have one copy of these guys will be a sum from m different from 0. Actually, we include everybody, minus infinity to infinity. So what do we get? We get, remember, when we take the derivatives, first of all, we get an ls square, right, from here. What else? We get l tilde. So let's put an m here, okay? So we're doing this integration, e to the minus 2i m sigma. So that would be one copy. But now we are supposed to contract this with another copy. Let's call it any favorite letters for the index. You cannot choose n because we're doing n here. J, k. Let's see, k, is there anything wrong with k? No, doesn't seem to be wrong. Okay. All right, and then the final guy here. Now we're supposed to do this. Let's cancel this here and here. So we get that this guy is a half, right? Let's put this a half here. Now we're supposed to carry out this sum. This is a sum over two sets of objects. Let's simplify the notation a little bit, and let's just put the dot, meaning the Lorentz contraction, and we get an integral from 0 to pi of d sigma e to the 2 pi I, e to the 2 I sigma. So what do we get? We get n minus m minus k. But this whole integral is nothing but delta n m plus k. Okay? So that's great because we can completely get rid of one of the sums and get what L tilde is, which I forgot the tilde here. So let's write L tilde is a half sum over m equals to minus infinity to infinity of now, k is log by this delta function to be what? N minus m. Yes?
There is a factor of pi again.
There is a factor of?
Well, indeed, you know, because if n equals m plus k, then you get from 0 to pi of 1.
Yeah, that's true. Let's see. Where did the factor of pi go? Well, I definitely like this formula. So one way to fix it is to put a factor of pi here, wherever appropriate, in order to normalize the guys the way I like them. Okay? Pi is not a function of sigma or tau, so that should be fine. Oh, great, great, great. Very good, very good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Here was the problem. Excellent, excellent. Yeah, yeah, excellent. Here it is. I said that this was equal to this, but it's inconsistent with this definition precisely because of what you said. There is a 1 over pi here. Very, very good. Very, very good. Okay. Okay, that's what I call teamwork. I mess up on the blackboard and you fix the problem. That's great. Of course, we can do the same thing for the other ones. And if you put the factors of pi correctly and everything, you will get the same thing, but now without the tildes. Okay? Now remember, the constraints happen to be that these functions are supposed to vanish, but these are the Fourier modes, so the function vanishes if and only if each of the Fourier modes vanish, because they are, as functions, they are independent functions. These guys are independent functions. So we must impose as constraints that all these guys vanish. Okay? So these are the constraints on the oscillators. Very good. But we went through the trouble of giving a meaning to this guy just because there is something special that happens with a constraint L0. Let's see what happens there. What is L0? So we get a half the sum over all m's of alpha m dot alpha minus m. This actually reminds me of something that I should have said. I don't remember if I said it yesterday. But there is another constraint we have to impose here on these oscillators, which is something very common that you probably have done many, many times, which is that when we have the expansion in Fourier modes of a real field or a real function . These Fourier modes don't have to be real. They are, in general, complex, right? So what do we do in order to ensure that we have a real function? Well, we impose a condition that this is a real function by taking the complex conjugate and making that equal to this, but that imposes a condition on the Fourier modes. What's the condition? Well, I'm sure you all know this very well. The condition is that the complex conjugate of this guy better be equal to the mode with minus m, and the same thing should happen for the tildes. Okay, so this is a reality condition for the functions x. Otherwise, we couldn't interpret these guys as being coordinates in spacetime, because they would be complex. Okay, so let's go back to this. We know that we have to impose that this vanishes. So let me expand this a little bit and take out the m equals to 0 piece. Say this is a half L0 square, okay, plus the rest. This has to vanish. But what is this guy? Remember, from your notes, we found that alpha 0 mu, precisely the piece that enters here, was proportional to the momentum, to the four momentum of the string in spacetime. So this object is proportional to p mu, p mu. Okay? But this is nothing but the mass of the object. But that's the eigenvalue of this Casimir, of this operator, is what we denote in spacetime as being the mass square of the object. So remember, in the case of the point-like particle, we also found the dispersion relation precisely from the constraints. So this is the equivalent statement. Okay? So if you take into account all the factors correctly, you will find the following. Okay? If you plug all the factors here, you will find that the mass of this closed string happens to be equal. So let me try. Given my record with the factors of pi's and 2 today, I don't think I want to try to get the 8 correctly here. Okay, that's what we get. Now, there is a more convenient way of writing this, which will be useful next, which is instead of summing over the whole set, remember that this is, look at this, and this is invariant under m goes to minus m, okay? And m equal to 0, the only fixed point is not included, so we can remove this sum over the whole set and just sum over half by putting an 8. And only summing from 1 to infinity. Did I get it right? Maybe I didn't get it right. Yeah, you see, I couldn't even get the factor of 2 correctly. So this guy happens to be half of this, right? Oh, no, then it's correct. Yeah, if I put half of that, then the A goes, yeah, very good. Now, there is something interesting. We found that alpha 0 and alpha 0 tilde happen to be the same. Remember, that was an important condition for us. So when we do the same thing for L0 tilde, we will find a similar formula, but now involving the alpha tilde oscillators. So people like to write a more symmetric formula between the oscillators by putting a factor of half and then adding up the two pieces. Okay? Very good. So I'll leave it as an exercise to repeat what we have done here, but for the open stream, and find what the mass of the open string has to be in terms of the oscillators. So let's put a tilde here and a tilde here. Okay. Any questions to this point? All right. So what else do we want? We have the mass of the object. We can just go home. I mean, that should be fine. But of course, somebody said today that we're supposed to quantize it, right? I mean, after all. That's where all the interesting things will happen when we try to quantize this object. Okay? Remember, we want to produce a theory of interacting strings. So we first have to quantize it and then introduce interactions in space-time somehow. But what is the first step towards quantization? If you have a classical field theory, what is the first thing that you do in order to prepare everything for the quantization, for the canonical quantization? Of course, you would say, no, but that's old-fashioned. We only like path integrals. Is that what you're going to say? Awesome. Then we could really skip and then do everything with the path integral. The catch with that is that we will have to suffer a little bit with lots of new math in order to actually perform the path integral quantization. But I encourage you to actually do it. That's actually a lot of fun to do the path integral quantization. But we're going to be a little bit we're going to use less sophisticated technology and pretend that all we know how to do is the canonical quantization. So what is the first step if you want to do canonical quantization? And you have a classical field theory. Well, the first step is to remember Poisson brackets, right? You have to compute the Poisson brackets of the theory, and that will give you the perfect springboard to jump into the quantization of the theory. Okay. So remember, we have our action. So our fields will be the x's, and we have to compute the canonical conjugate field to this. And in order to do that, we perform the variation with respect to this. And what is this variation going to be? Just going to be this. Do you remember how this happens? If you perform this variation on this, how come that this is what I get? Well, all you have to remember really is that when you take a variation with respect to a particular field, right, these are functional variations. These are And a functional variation produces a delta function, right? The delta function localizes the integral, and that's why you get something like this. Okay? Very good. So this is a canonical momentum conjugated to our x variable. Well, once we have this, we can check that the Poisson brackets, usually in classical mechanics, people denote the Poisson brackets with curly brackets. But remember, yesterday we introduced curly brackets as well, as being anti-commutators. So we don't want to confuse things. So let's keep these guys as commutators, which they are, but these are not quantum commutators. So we will have to put Poisson bracket here to remind ourselves that this is what we mean. And when we consider Poisson brackets, what do we usually do with the time? Do we consider Poisson brackets at different times? At equal times, but different sigmas. And this is what we get. Now, there is a catch here. We have to be careful, because all these functions are periodic in sigma. So this delta function has to be some special delta function, which we'll call delta p. It's a periodic delta function. So what do we mean by that? Well, we mean a delta function defined so that if we integrate as a distribution, it's a distribution that does the following. Okay. So I believe if I get the factors right, the pi factors, that this delta function will be something of the form, well, actually, you can just sum. E to the I Well, it turns out I'm missing a 2 here. So show that under this definition, this happens. Okay? So this is a correct delta function we're supposed to use, because we have functions that are periodic in sigma. Okay? Now, the other Poisson brackets are the standard ones. So what is this supposed to be? Very good. And also equal to okay. Now we can use this here in this formula to conclude that, and the reason we're going to do it is that we're going to plug in the oscillators in. Eta mu nu, and then we get our special delta function. Okay? So now we are supposed to plug in the oscillators from the function that we had before here. Okay, so we plug in the oscillators, the oscillator expansion of these functions. And from there, we learn that the oscillators, we have to satisfy the following identity. So if we have the Poisson bracket of these oscillators, is going to be equal to this. The same thing is going to happen for the tildes. And the Poisson bracket between the alphas and the alpha tildes will happen to be 0. Okay. Sorry. Depending on the convention, we could also say alpha m and then alpha of minus m, and then put it the way I had it before. But it's more conventional to just start with alpha m and alpha n here, and then put a delta function that tells you that they only have a non-zero Poisson bracket when n happens to be equal to minus n, okay? Which is a natural thing to do. Remember, when we impose the reality condition on the axis, we found that alpha minus m happens to be the complex conjugate of the other one. So when we quantize, the complex conjugation will go into the adjoint of operator. So we'll get that these two guys are adjoints of each other only when this condition is satisfied, when m plus n is equal to 0. Okay? Very good. Yeah, so I mean, these computations are a little bit long to do it on the blackboard, so that's why they will be in the homework. But there is yet one more computation that one has to do, which is to compute the Poisson brackets of the modes of the energy momentum tensor. Okay. So remember, we had our LMs. And LM tildes. So we want to compute the Poisson bracket of these guys now using the Poisson brackets of the alphas. And it's actually not that terrible, the exercise. Just so happens to be this. Person for getting the I. But this is quite interesting. If you look at this, this is looking like what? Yeah? It's looking like an algebra, and this algebra has a name. It's a Virasoro algebra. And of course, you have seen conformal field theory by now. So you probably recognize this and have studied this, even the quantum version, presumably. So somebody's laughing. That means...
Sorry, conformal field theory is really traumatizing.
It's really, sorry?
It was really traumatizing.
Oh. So this is not a conformal field theory. Well, it is, but... Let's not, yes.
In the Virasoro algebra, don't we have a central Schwarz number?
Yes, not in the classical theory. So we're doing classical. Okay? So we only have Poisson brackets here. So you will show precisely that if we use these classical Poisson brackets, so we have just Poisson brackets, this is what happens. Okay? So now that you're asking, let's see how much time we have. Yes?
Aren't those L's constants?
Sorry?
Aren't the L's constant?
Yeah, now we are treating them. Yeah, so you would say the same thing about the alphas, right?
Yes.
Right. So, yeah, very good. So now we are treating them as being the variables on which we're expanding the space of functions. Okay? Remember, well, we can have the space of functions on a line. Then we have to use a Fourier transform. But these are functions that only depend, that are periodic. So we can expand them on a discrete set of bases. Okay? So these guys will end up being, or these guys are precisely the guys that we use to expand these spaces of functions. And that's why it's meaningful to define Poisson brackets for them. Yeah. So let me just mention something about Well, yeah. Listen, let me just mention something about quantization. Of course, we did all this because we want to jump to quantization of the system. So this was towards quantization. Now it's very easy to do quantization because what we do is to replace every Poisson bracket by a commutator. And every object that we have, these guys that were expanding our space of functions, will become operators acting on some Hilbert space. And we only restrict, we will define annihilation operators, everything that has positive m's, and creation operators from the reality condition. So the creation operators, remember we had this condition with the star. Okay. So we don't think about these guys anymore, and we simply introduce annihilation operators which will play the role of these guys. Okay. Now thinking in terms of these guys like this, you find that this algebra almost looks like the algebra of harmonic oscillators. Right? So let's plug this in here. Now this is quantum. So what do we have? We have that is something that looks like this. So this almost looks like harmonic oscillators if it wasn't for this annoying M here, right? So one way to fix that problem is to define new operators as 1 over the square root of M. And the dagger of the operators and in terms of this, we just get the usual commutators for harmonic oscillators. Or do we? What do you think? Do you remember for a harmonic oscillator, what are we supposed to get? Sorry? Just one. Very good. That's what we're supposed to get for a harmonic oscillator. So let's take here, well, this is not very important. This is only saying that we need the same m's, right? Otherwise, we get something like this. Yeah, this is coming from here, right? So let's pretend that we're looking at the same m. So we don't worry about this. We only have this. Now, almost everything here will look like a harmonic oscillator. Imagine that we have, for a space-like component, we get 1, right? If I goes from 1 to d minus 1, the dimension of the space-time. But what happens when we look at the zero component? What do we get? Well, from here, we get a very annoying minus 1. Why is that minus 1 annoying? What do you think is going to happen if you try to quantize a harmonic oscillator with a minus 1 there? Yeah, you get negative norm states. which is definitely something funny. So remember, we define the vacuum of the theory as being a state in the Hilbert space that is annihilated by all these guys. Okay? So that's the definition of the vacuum of the theory. So we can consider, say, one of these guys, one of the creation operators acting on this guy, and it's supposed to give us, this is supposed to give us a state. So let's call this state psi. If we compute the norm of the state, we're going to get something that looks like this. Really? Are you saying that the A's are the creation operators and the A dagger are the annihilation operators? What do you mean before? We?
Yeah, you.
No, but this is the first time we're talking about creation and annihilation operators, right?
Have we done the quantum stream before?
What's the signature of the metric?
Oh, the signature of the metric.
-1, -1, 1, 1.
I think this is a standard convention, right?
Yeah.
The operators without dagger are the annihilation operators. They annihilate the vacuum. So that's how you define the vacuum. Mm-hmm. The state in the Hilbert space when that happens. So we can create a state. Let's look at a state with created by this creation operator with a zero here,
the zero component, and let's compute the norm. Well, now if you compute the norm from here, just by using the commutation relation, you get -1. Okay? Very good. So I'll leave this story up to here, okay? So sadly, I'll have to leave you over the weekend with the idea that when we quantize this theory, we get these negative norm states, right? So that sounds terrible. But remember, we're just doing the quantization of the oscillator modes. We still have to impose the constraints, right? And the constraints are the ones that are going to save us. Precisely, you would say, well, this is only one state. Who cares? We can probably project it out somehow. It's only one state. But it turns out that it's not true, there is only one state, because you can check that if you make a state by a string of operators, any number of operators you would like to put, and if you put an odd number of zero component creation operators, you will get a state that has negative norm as well. So you get an infinite set of states in your Hilbert space with negative norm. Well, in order to get rid of an infinite set of negative norm states, you will probably need to impose an infinite set of conditions. But we are lucky because we have an infinite set of constraints to impose. So it turns out that these infinite sets of constraints are precisely enough to kill all these negative norm states or to project them out. Okay? So, yeah, I should probably stop now. But I want to make one more comment. Not about this, but about what we discussed yesterday. I don't know, because I want to encourage you to try over the weekend this little game I told you about of producing super multiplets in four dimensions with massless states. Okay? So let me just use 5 more minutes. Because yesterday, I said everything very, very quickly, and as I'll probably have to do today. So back to 4 dimensions and Susie. This is what we were doing yesterday. And we said that we had these anti-commutators for the supercharges, okay? And we said that we wanted to consider massless states. So if you have a massless state, you cannot go to the rest frame. What's the best next thing that you can do if you have a massless particle? Well, you can go to a frame where two of the three spatial components vanishes, right? So you can set two of these components to vanish. That's the best thing that you can do. And then this will be basically the energy. So this is the best thing that you can do when you have massless particles. You cannot go to the rest frame, but you can go to this frame. And if you do that and you contract with the Pauli matrices, you find something very interesting. This is an exercise. Don't get confused by, don't get scared by this notation. These are the regular Pauli matrices. Well, you would say, but there are only three Pauli matrices. How come that you have four? Because mu has four indices. Well, the fourth one, the zeroth component of this, is nothing but the identity. Okay? So this vector is the identity with the Pauli matrices. So an exercise is to contract this with this and show that this becomes a matrix of the form. Okay? Now, when you plug this in here, it tells you that the one component of the supercharges behaves like a harmonic oscillator again, but a fermionic harmonic oscillator. And the Q2 dots actually should anti-commute. Okay? So we should impose that these guys don't do anything on our Hilbert states. They annihilate everything, so they are represented as zero. We should not consider them. We only consider the one dot component. Okay? And the last thing that I want to say is that one of the exercises you had was to assume that we had many of these guys. As many as n. And I wanted you to compute what happens when you have four of them and you start with a state with -1 helicity and you start applying these guys. Now, know that you can only apply Q1, okay? We only have Q1i. Let's denote it as Qi. Let's forget about the index I. So we know that Q1 for any I squared is 0. So we can only apply one of them, okay? Either Q1, Q2, Q3, or Q4. We can only apply one of them. And they all anti-commute. So if we start with this guy, we can apply Qi to it. And how many states of helicity -1/2 do we get? How many states can we get? Well, as many as the index I, right? Because all of them are different supercharges. So we get 4 in this case. How about applying two of them? So somebody said here that you get states with 0 helicity, you get 6. Why do you get 6? You would think that you get 4 times 4, right? Yeah, but these guys anti-commute. So this must be an anti-symmetric matrix, right? So a 4x4 anti-symmetric matrix, how many independent components you have? Only 6. Now if you continue, 3 guys, how many do you get? 4. And the last guy, how many do you get? 1. Okay? So this is the famous statement that n equals 4, super Young-Mills, is Young-Mills because we have a gauge boson, has one gauge boson that has 2 independent degrees of freedom, which corresponds to the 2 helicities. It has 4 fermions and 6 scalars. Okay? So the exercise that I want you to do is to do the same thing for n equals 8 supergravity, meaning take n equals 8 and start with -2. So do the same counting. Okay? You should find if you add up everything, you should find 256 states. Okay? So that's a challenge. Find 256 states. Yeah. I think it would be very hard to get the thing wrong and still get 256. So if you get 256, you're sure you're right. Yeah. Okay. Let's stop here.